All right, so maybe since I know I got here at the stroke of nine, we should probably get underway, I guess. Okay, so welcome everybody. This is the panel on the protagonist, shortly to be followed by the panel on the antagonist, obviously. I guess what we'll do is start to the left and just introduce ourselves quickly and who we are. And then we'll talk a little bit about the subject, about what we've done in our own work, about protagonists that we have known and love, about how to make them more interesting. I know the antagonist is currently in vogue, but maybe we can do a little bit of reclamation project on that actual hero. It sounds kind of weird. And then after we're done with that, we'll probably try to leave maybe 15, 20 minutes for conversation, questions, things of that kind. If you haven't done so already, especially because you're tired, now I know I just remembered when I was walking in here, please silence the cell phones so we don't get in the middle of that. Then everyone scrambles for this. So that we can make sure that we're focused on what's going on here, and I think that's it. So I guess we'll
and we want tickets.
Oh yes, thank you. And right, if you just came in and you have tickets, if you could please bring them forward, we need that to make sure that everyone's coming to these things.
And you're supposed to do a rough head count and jot it on the paper. They're on their own little box.
Okay, that's fine.
Also, the folks in the back are
okay. Okay.
Yeah. We can speak up. You can also move up. There's plenty of seats. I mean, what about our needs, you know? That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. I'm just not going to hurt anybody.
Thank you.
Maybe not for the people out there.
Thank you, wonderful people all.
It'll be all right for us.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think he's still around somewhere doing shows.
Yeah.
Okay. Sure, of course. Okay, so let's start on the left, maybe with Linda, and introduce yourself, and then we'll go right and figure out why we're here and so forth.
Hi, I'm Linda Baker. I have two Dragonlance novels still hanging around somewhere, about 15 short stories in anthologies. I'm working on a fantasy novel, and I have just sort of finalized the arrangements with an acquaintance to write a nonfiction book for her.
I'm Richard Lee Byers. I write fantasy and horror. I've done a string of Forgotten Realms novels in recent years that some of you may have seen. My most recent book is The Captive Flame.
Cool. My name is Gregory Wilson. I am an associate professor of English at St. John's University in New York City. That's my day job, but I'm increasingly an author. My first book, which is a work of epic fantasy, came out last year from Gail Sengage called The Third Sign. That was actually just within the last month optioned for a film, which is pretty cool. I have a second book, which is currently being shopped to publishers by my agent, and I'm working on a third. I'm also editing an anthology on speculative fiction and politics with a number of authors, some of whom are in the Writers' Symposium, in fact. So I'm hoping, you know, and it's co-edited by John Helfers, who is another member of the symposium here. So I'm hoping that's going to go well. And I think that's all for me.
Hey, everybody, I'm Brad Bollier. I write both science fiction and fantasy in short form. I have, close to 15 sales out there in the world. I do have a signing coming up later on at 1 at Author's Alley, and I also have a reading coming up at noon today, and Paul Jeunesse and Kelly Swales are going to be helping me with that. And I have an epic fantasy trilogy I just sold to Nightshade Books that will be coming out next year. Thanks.
I'm Dave Gross. I've edited a number of magazines and some books for a small publisher up in Alberta, in Canada. I published about 5 novels with TSR/Wizards/Hasbro, notably in the Sembia series with Richard and 5 of our closest writing friends. Most recently, I've returned to fantasy fiction with a novel called Prince of Wolves, published by Paizo. Yesterday was the release. I'm signing that every day over at the Paizo booth in the afternoons. And as for what's coming up next, I can talk about it tomorrow at 2 o'clock at the Paizo Tales panel.
Cool. All right, so I guess the best thing to get started with is two questions for everybody. And the first is, what do we think constructs a really interesting protagonist, either examples that you've seen that inspired you in terms of writing protagonists of your own, or ones that you've worked on your own without inspiration? And then the second part of it is, how do you do it? I mean, how have you actually gone about using those protagonists in your own work?
Well, one thought I had for this panel was, Patrick Nielsen Hayden, who is the head editor at Tor, I went to a writing workshop with him, and he said on this subject, novels are about interesting people, extraordinary people doing extraordinary things. And it was in regards to a review that we were doing on some of the stories that everybody had submitted for the workshop, in which one of the protagonists was a little too everyday, right? You get a lot of stories, and I've written stories, that you try to show someone rising above, and in doing so, you kind of write them in their kind of normal everyday world, and they're... It's only towards the end of the book where they really rise up and come into their own and overcome the obstacles that are facing them. But frankly, those first two-thirds are not interesting reading. You know, people want to read about extraordinary people. Now, saying that, it has to be tempered with a little bit of reality, right? You also have the flip side where you have characters that are just too powerful. Anton Strout yesterday brought up this interesting point about writing Superman. Well, that's kind of hard, actually, right? I mean, they rebooted Superman because he was too powerful. Having somebody that has no faults, except for perhaps one, Kryptonium, it's difficult, you know. So I think finding that balance is kind of a key to making a good protagonist.
As we were just settling in, we had an interesting point that the main character of a story was not necessarily a protagonist. He could be an antagonist. I'm going to disagree. In screenwriting terminology, or in a particular school of screenwriting terminology, you don't necessarily talk about a protagonist. You talk about your point of view character. And that point of view character comes with what some call the center of good. And when you become sympathetic to that character, when you see the world through his or her eyes, you adopt that character's center of good. Even if that character is a son of a bitch, you start to sympathize with that person. And that person might not be a very good person, but that's still your main character. That's still your point of view character. And to call that person an antagonist confuses the issue, because that person is opposing other forces, be they other people or the environment, and that's the antagonist, even if your character is wicked. I didn't realize it at the time that I first became a big fan of Roger Zelazny, but as a kid, I loved The Chronicles of Amber. And when you start those books, it's clear to you that Corwin is the hero. He's a good guy. But if you are paying attention, about halfway through the series, you realize, no, actually, he's kind of a villain in the eyes of everybody else. He's the one who brings this terrible curse down on his family and his land. But you never for a moment think of him as an antagonist or a villain until later you see him reflected in the eyes of others. So I like to think less of protagonists and more of point of view characters, whether they're good or bad.
I think that's an important point, in part because what we'll talk about in this one, what we'll talk about in the antagonist panel too, is creating characters that live and breathe and that are comfortable in their own skin, right? So that even those who act in sort of an objectively a negative way, whether, you know, from the point of view of other people, I suppose, themselves have to look in the mirror and, you know, wake up with themselves and say, I'm doing something for some reasonably justified reason. If you want to take a movie example and you look at a character like Mad Max, right, or Jason Bourne as another example from the Bourne movies, a guy who kills, who assassinates, who does all these things, right, and yet there is some kind of basic sense that he's doing what he thought was the right thing, and then when he realizes it wasn't, tries to do other things that now become his new right thing, right? And we become sympathetic with him despite the fact that this guy leaves a trail of bodies behind him, right? And one could say the same thing about Mad Max and the whole vigilante justice example or the Amber example that you used before. So in part, a lot of it is dependent upon getting the reader to not necessarily love the character that you present as the protagonist, but to understand them, to be able to identify with them long enough for them to give you their own narrative. I have a friend who says that everyone is entitled to his or her own narrative, right? And so to the degree that you can present that narrative to your audience, you've done your job right by the character. And if you don't do that, then I think if you make the protagonist into a, if it's a stereotypical hero, very cookie-cutter, obvious, will always save the damsel in distress, will never do anything that even sort of shades things towards the gray side of ambiguity. You know, if you do that, then you're creating a character that you probably don't believe in that much, frankly. You're just writing by type, and certainly your reader won't believe in either. So allowing your character to speak for him or herself is a big part of making a protagonist as well, too. So.
I'm going to disagree a little bit with the everyman thing, which, you know, this may explain why I'm not a tour author, but explain it in part. But I mean, I think that the everyman who steps up thing sometimes can work really well. I think it works often in horror novels, I think in those stories, you know, it works because, you know, it's not an everyman in all senses. It's somebody that's living kind of an everyman life, where he doesn't have the opportunity to exercise the extraordinary capacity for courage or whatever that he's going to find within himself. But those qualities are going to have to emerge and be tested in the course of the story, But in one sense, he's an everyman. It's not like, oh, he's like that guy's like Sherlock Holmes. You know, he's clearly awesome from the moment he steps on stage. As far as what I think makes a good protagonist is one thing I think that often makes a good protagonist. So, you know, there are few absolutes in fiction, and there are a lot of things we can tell you that are generally true, but you always be able to find the exception and say, well, you know, he said that it should always be this, but it wasn't like that in that book, and I love that book. That was an awesome book. But that said, I think what is often makes an effective protagonist and, an effective major character, for that matter, is that the author is successful in conveying the idea that the character has a life beyond the constraints and the requirements of the story.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that there's the other things happen to him before page one,
right?
You know, and maybe he has other concerns, you know, other concerns even than what's going on during the course of the story, and you know that if he makes it out alive, you know, there will be some sort of a life that continues. We mentioned Superman, you know, it's like, well, Superman is so hard to write an effective, tight, suspenseful adventure story about Superman, because if he just exercises his powers with any degree of intelligence, which writers tend to not have him do for this very reason, you know, he's never really going to get in serious trouble.
How much Krypton can you find on one planet, honestly? Like, I mean,
well, the guy moves at super speed, right? And if the guy,
it's not a bullet with his eye.
Well, what I'm saying is, if you move at super speed, as you're approaching, you know, Lex Luthor's latest, you know, the site of Lex Luthor's, you know, next plot, you know, you take that millionth of a second and you use all your super senses to scan the potential battlefield and look for the traps and the hidden kryptonite and stuff, and you're going to be okay. Yeah, but the point I wanted to make is that you know, Superman is, despite the huge handicap writers have in trying to write tight, you know, taut, suspenseful adventure fiction about Superman, he's been around for a long time, and I think that part of it is, in fact, all the stuff that's built onto him other than his superpowers, you know, his relationships with secondary characters in the story, and, you know, his, you know, ongoing subplots with trying to enlarge the bottled city of Kandor and his feelings about being the last Kryptonian and being a double orphan. First he loses Jor-El and Lara, subsequently he loses the Kansas, although Kurt Cotton, that's not true anymore, but it worked for a long time. And I think that you definitely want your protagonist to some degree, probably all your major characters to, you know, there should be, you know, it's tricky because you can't give it a lot of time, you know. The plot always has to be cranking, but nevertheless, you got to work in some stuff that gives a sense of the character has a life beyond just what's going to happen in your old story.
I read somewhere that the protagonist is the prime mover in your story. He represents, or she represents, the move to change the status quo, whereas the antagonist is resistant to change.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
You don't think so?
I think that a whole lot of fantasy stories, the antagonist, the villain, is the one that wants to come in and destroy the established order and bring evil and chaos, and the hero is the defender of the status quo. I like Lord of the Rings.
Well, and well, to play off that, one of the, you know, many of you may have heard that term that John Milton was of the devil's party but did not know it, and they're referring to this idea that in Paradise Lost, if you read Paradise Lost, you'll find that God, who is represented, if you wonder if authors have egos, you need look no further than Milton thinking he could represent God. God does not come off well in Paradise Lost. God is, I hate to say this, it's going to sound odd, arrogant, perhaps that doesn't really work when God is concerned, but, you know, God comes off as, in some ways, dismissive, sarcastic, and the one who is really, in fact, the, not just hero, but protagonist, to make a distinction there, is Satan. In the first 8-9 books, Satan, in the first book, he's described as he rose from the depths and his massive shield and the flames. And he is really not only the most dramatically interesting character, but he is really the one that you come close to identifying with as you read the story. It's a very uncomfortable feeling for people who come from a very Christian perspective and enter that poem and think, this is not the way things are supposed to go. And a lot of people argue the reason is because Milton was interested in Satan's ability to sort of subvert, you know, the established order and to go against order. And in that sense, the, you know, the hero sort of technically the good side would be representing a kind of stasis that Satan ultimately undercuts. In that sense, Satan, though we clearly are supposed to ultimately root against him, is the protagonist for a good portion of that story. And I think that gets back to your point about the idea that it's not always the case that protagonist equals good, antagonist equals evil, right? It has to do with, again, the point of view character, who you identify with. And we should point out very quickly that that can also shift during the course of a book, and you can find that another protagonist essentially rises to take the place of the one that began the book. Either that's done explicitly, where there'll be a part that says, George R. Martin's is a good example of this, right, where you'll have different ones that literally say, you know, John, right, or, you know, different characters, Daenerys. These different characters are the ones that you're following. Or it can be done implicitly, which is what I think happens in something like Paradise Lost, where as you go through, you start realizing that, well, but despite the fact that he looked heroic, Satan is really actually petty and vile and does other things that are not. So Milton kind of veers away at the last second almost from making you really think, yeah, go Satan. But in the first several books, that's not the way it is. So the protagonist can shift, but in either case, you know, following the character that creates the most energy in the story sometimes means that you're going with someone who isn't objectively good in that sense.
I love the example that you just used. I think the genius of Milton and the character of Lucifer is not so much that he's presenting him as a protagonist, but that in presenting his perspective, he's trying to understand and to help us understand the origin, the motive of evil. Mm-hmm. Why would anyone rebel?
Yeah.
Why would somebody in a lofty position like Lucifer rebel against the ultimate authority? And by giving us a reason, he's allowing us to understand how evil begins, rather than to say that Lucifer is a hero. Certainly he was a hero up to the point until he makes his choice. But that's a great example. Yep. The one that I often like to use is Hamlet, because it's difficult for us to fully appreciate his conflict unless you're very devout. It's difficult to understand the clash between his need for revenge, which is kind of the Spanish element of Hamlet, and his reluctance to murder. Because he knows it's wrong to murder.
Yep.
And that's one of the things that stays his hand. And then, an interesting thing happens in the play. How many people remember the story of Hamlet pretty well? Okay, let me set up just a little bit for those of you who might not remember it. Hamlet has seen the ghost of his father tell him that he was murdered by his brother. And he's not supposed to trust a ghost. He's a good Christian boy. And he knows that spirits are capable of lying. And yet, he believes it. He thinks the ghost of his father has told him the truth. He's resentful of his uncle, and he thinks he's a villain. And he's right, as it turns out. His uncle really is the villain. And yet, to act on the advice of a spirit, of a potentially evil force, is dangerous to his soul. And he balks at killing Claudius until he has a golden opportunity. Nobody is around. It's like Kill Dr. Lucky. Nobody can stop him. And then Claudius kneels down to pray. And Hamlet makes a faithful decision not to kill him. And his motive is, I don't want to kill him because he murdered my father without my father being able to do penance and go to heaven. And that's why my father is a ghost now. I don't want to kill him when his soul might go to hell, or to heaven. I want to kill him when his soul will go to hell. And that is when Hamlet becomes the evil hero of his own story. He makes the decision to do this wicked, wicked thing, which is why Hamlet's a tragedy. A lot of the times, when a modern audience looks at Hamlet, we think, this guy's not tragic at all. He's a good guy just trying to do the right thing. No. In fact, what he's doing is very, very wicked, and he knows it. He doesn't want to do it. He doesn't want to face that part of himself, but at the end, he does. In the moment of great anger, when he sees how he's been betrayed by several other people. So, hero, maybe not so much.
How about the narrator in Telltale Heart?
Sure.
Yes.
or Cask of Amontillado, for that matter.
Yeah. We identify with them and we don't want to.
Yeah. Brett?
I would urge people to think, not get too wrapped up necessarily in the kind of the hero's journey type stories, the Joseph Campbell stories, a lot of the adventure, heroic fantasy is that type of story. But I could recommend one book, Orson Scott Card's Characters and Viewpoint. And in it, he talks about the mice quotient, M-I-C-E. There's four kinds of stories. There's the milieu story, and Larry Niven's Ring World,
yeah.
Integral Trees, kind of falls into that category. And it's where the hero, quote-unquote, is kind of going through an amazing land and kind of learning about it, and you're learning about it with him. And so the antagonist in this case, we're kind of crossing over a little bit, is the world itself. And then the I is the idea story, which is kind of typically like a mystery, like something happens early on, a body is shown, and then the rest of the story is figuring out what happened. C is a character story in which the character finds something in themselves that they don't like, and they want to change. And really, the rest of the story is about them doing that. And so the antagonist in that case might be the world, society, their preconceived notions about themselves and the world. And so they're rising above to challenge those things and challenge themselves and change. And then E, the last, is the event story, which is some event, Lord of the Rings, Sauron taking over. That event is looming, and the heroes have to kind of rise to the occasion and stop it. So I think it's important not to lump all fiction into this kind of heroic fantasy. Just think about that a little bit when you think about your protagonists.
One thing I wanted to mention too, one good point that you make there is that it is, I think, much easier to conceive of as an antagonist in a story as being the environment against which, your characters are set, right? It's difficult to make the protagonist that, right? For one thing, they need to be telling the story, and I'm sure someone will come, well, what about the living tree story I read? Okay, I'm sure, I know there are examples, but even then, you have to anthropomorphize them to make it make sense, right? You can't just have a bunch of sighing wind on a bunch of pages and be like, well, I think they're telling a story, So they need to be able to kind of, the protagonist needs to be able to push the story forward and be someone active and very human, and I think Brad's point just there is very important, because it's true. We have a variety of different stories. The common element is that in each of these cases, you're dealing with very human people dealing with very human things. And the more that you can represent that humanity, whether it's the everyman sort of figuring out in a difficult situation what they're with, or whether it's someone who has these superpowers but has very human flaws. And that, by the way, that's the one saving grace of a protagonist like Superman, right? I mean, although he is all-powerful, and I made the joke about how much Krypton can you actually find on one planet, the truth still is that he has these very human flaws. In fact, he himself identifies with his own human flaws more than he does his superhumanity in a lot of ways. This is why he makes the choice at one point, as you all remember, to become human. He doesn't want to have to deal with this. Why would you willingly move away from being able to fly around the world, reverse time? I mean, this is an awfully big decision that he makes. But he does it for very human reasons. He does it because he is in love with a human woman, because he has those sort of human emotions that are represented in him. And what we find compelling about these people is not their superpowers. Those are cool, right? But what we find compelling about them is the things they use their superpowers for, is the human elements that make those superpowers matter. Otherwise, you're just following robots around, and no one is interested in robots unless you make the robots seem rather human, in which case we're dealing with a different subject.
We mentioned the
cards, mice classification, and we've mentioned, the hero's journey and all that. My general stance on all that stuff is that it's really valuable to look at those ideas, assimilate them, and then kind of forget them when you actually sit down to write your own story. I mean, because I think you can get really tripped up if you say, by God, my plot's going to follow the hero's journey. You know, I know what it's supposed to look like.
What letter is this? It's not MICE. Yeah. No.
MICE is like, you don't want to say, I must make sure, I'm writing a milieu story, so, screw character, It's like, I know what I'm supposed to be emphasizing. I mean, with the example of, a lot of stories are going to partake of more than one of those categories. We mentioned Lord of the Rings is it's the event story because it's about, Sauron's about to take over Middle Earth and by God, we've got to stop him. Clearly an event story. Also, though, clearly a milieu story. The point of that story is to give you a guided tour of Middle Earth. From another point of view, we're going to say, okay, we're going to see what's Fangorn Forest look like. Well, here it is. What do the Mines of Moria look like? Well, here they are.
And also a character story.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that all these ideas have a validity and a great usefulness to them, but don't. Use them to enrich your understanding. Don't use them to put a straitjacket on the way you approach telling a story.
Can we think of a few examples of, not in our own work, but very, we mentioned a couple, like the protagonist in Amber. Are there other, and we've mentioned Superman 6,000 times now. Do we have some other examples we have of protagonists that really stood out for us as we were first reading and becoming involved in writing?
This is a bit of a throwback, but something I don't think we see enough of today, and I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, but I'm a writer of pulp fiction. I think many of my peers are writers of pulp fiction. I mean that in the most complimentary possible way. And I think one of the greatest achievements you could ever have as a writer of pulp fiction is to have a character who is remembered years and years afterward. Even if you don't remember the specific stories, you remember Tarzan of the Apes. You remember John Carter of Mars. You remember Doc Savage and the Shadow and all of the rest.
Mike Hammer,
all these iconic characters who transcend their stories. And those are the ones that I would mention. I would mention those old characters because we know that they've endured.
Yeah.
The characters today who will endure, we'll know who they are in 30 years.
Yeah, okay.
Travis McGee is a great example.
Some of the standing out right now is Cool Hand Luke. Was that Paul Newman?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Sure.
Kind of the classic anti-hero.
Sure.
Yeah, very vivid for me.
Sure.
Well, for me, certainly Fofford and the Grey Mouser.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And are two of the... I mean, to me, that's like the pinnacle of heroic fantasy, those stories. I truly love them. And so those characters, certainly a number of the characters that I loved growing up have already been mentioned. I devoured the Saint novels by Leslie Charteris when I was a kid. And that's a character that's really sort of just the pinnacle of a cool adventure, always has a quip, always knows what to do.
Yep.
Handsome, women love him, men want to be that's a really good example of the kind of real kind of wish fulfillment protagonist and done well. Obviously there are a lot of great characters. Corwin of Ambrose, and Sherlock Holmes, but...
You took mine.
Why about you?
Which
know,
one?
I just kind of reiterated some days.
Yeah, which one?
Yeah.
Sherlock.
Sherlock Holmes. Indiana Jones.
Yeah, I was thinking Han Solo, too, although, he's got that roguish side that makes that work. Mm-hmm. And you're never really quite sure which way he's going to go, which is what I think is cool. Yeah. This character that starts out one way and winds up somewhere along the line being twisted.
Yep. I think that goes back to the Hamlet example, too. If you have a protagonist that you're not 100% sure whether you're going to be able to get behind them, but you follow them all along their very interesting storyline, I think you have a winner. The example I was thinking of, and I kind of cringe because I had a very uncomfortable reaction to this book as a kid, but was the Thomas Covenant series.
Oh, yeah.
You, I mean, you can't read Lord Falsbane and the books that follow up with it without having extraordinarily mixed feelings, unless there's something wrong with you, without having extraordinarily mixed feelings towards the character of Thomas Covenant, right? Yeah. Who is, in some ways, imagines himself as and is seen by others in the real world as physically repulsive because of his leprosy, is seen by us as emotionally repulsive because he's a rapist, and that's straight out what happens in the book. He doesn't even deny it. And it's a very, very uncomfortable feeling then to find yourself interested in his story while being simultaneously sort of, you know, repulsed by him. But I think it's an important lesson. Whether or not you like the book is not as important as the fact that you remember the character. And in that particular case, it's significant because the character is something that stays with you after you close the pages. I read an interesting quote about an author recently who has written a massive series that I won't go into. You would know him if I mentioned him. But it's a massive series with these huge series of books, and they're all epic fantasy books, and the comment I read was that I was really fascinated by the books, but I closed the book and I can't remember a single one of the characters. And there are literally hundreds of characters in this series. There are tons and tons and tons of them all over the place. And a lot of them are, as you're reading them, very interesting and unusual, but they don't stay with you. And I think part of the reason for that is, one, because they're too many. I think there's only so much that your brain space can kind of handle at once. And the point of view shifts are so rapid that you kind of just start thinking, well, the world's cool, but do you know what happened? Nah, but it's this cool stuff, and there were dragons, I think. I don't know. Stuff happened, you know. And you don't remember anything sort of distinctive about it. But the other reason, I think, is that there may be a sense that the author in this case, this is just a theory of mine, wasn't willing to invest fully in a protagonist even for a period of time. That doesn't mean, as I said, that you have to limit yourself to one protagonist only. But it does mean that you need to be willing to invest time in that protagonist and to really develop that story. And one of the things you may hear from all of us during the course of the weekend about talking on the Writer's Symposium is that it's very important that a lot of the work that you put into your books, you need to remember that readers are not going to see openly much of the work that you've put in. A lot of that is behind the scenes stuff. But if you do not do it, if you don't do the behind the scenes stuff, if you don't know the things that were happening to that person before the author picked him up, then you're not going to have a believable character. You have what we call the puppet problem, right, where they're just sort of sitting in a closet, and then the book opens it up, and now the author is going to move them around. Well, the reason we call them wooden puppets is we don't find them interesting because we know that it's a cheat, right? As readers, we know this person never really exists. You just made this guy up, right? You're like, I need to come up with, you know, hero protagonist, who, by the way, is a character in Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash. Maybe I should just, you know, put him in the center. But see, Stevenson does it deliberately because he's trying to be ironic about it. Some authors would be like, I don't get it. That's what I do. So I think the important thing is to be able to do the work, whether you're writing a protagonist or antagonist, to give the background that will allow the reader, when they start reading, to feel that this is a real breathing character, and that when they close the book, they'll go on living in some bizarre way in their own world, and as a result, they'll go on living in your own head, too. Other thoughts before we start taking questions and comments?
One character that I really like, a series that I really like, is there's a mystery series by Max Allen Collins called, I don't know if there's an overarching title. The hero is a character named Nathan Heller, and he's a private detective, and he starts out in Prohibition-era Chicago, and his adventures, I guess at this point, I think Collins is actually going to write some more, run up through the 1950s, and all his adventures relate to historical personages and things like that. There's one of the novels is about the Lindbergh kidnapping. One of them is about the disappearance of Amelia Earhart, and one of them is about Roswell. You know, and you find out the truth that could not be told until now about all these things. All these mysteries are solved, but what really sticks with you is Heller as a character. He's a really well drawn character, and it's very interesting because he's very sympathetic, the way that Collins started out writing was he'd read a thing. It's like a private eye hero. Would never do A, B, C, D. These things are against the private eye code. And I forget what they are, but one of them's like taking a bribe. And Collins made the deliberate choice in the first novel to have him do every one of those things. But he comes across and he's constantly operating in this gray area where he makes a lot of compromises and questionable choices, which is kind of interesting because a lot of times when you read about private eye things, they're operating in this gray world of compromise, but the private eye always often turns out to be like a real straight arrow who never you know, who never really partakes of that ambiguity. But Heller's all over that. You know? but it's a fascinating series with a really well drawn the protagonist that you actually follow from when he's a young man into into his old age, because the books are actually, you know, the books are actually being told by him as a senior citizen, as he's writing his memoirs, and you actually do get glimpses of that life too. So you see this character throughout his life, and it's as good an example as you'll find about, you know, a character that is rich and interesting and you like, and whose life is just laid out as much as it could be.
It's a good argument not to avoid ambiguity, by the way, or not to be afraid of ambiguity in your characterizations, because that is, we are ambiguous by nature in a lot of ways. So, sorry, Brad.
Oh, no, that's okay. I just have one kind of closing comment on mind. I would urge people, I always searched for kind of shades of gray in characters, both in the protagonist and the antagonist. And when we're talking about kind of these anti-heroes and stuff, I think it's very important that I made this mistake. I made a character I thought was great, you know, and it wasn't, you know, it didn't have kind of, you know, normal man qualities throughout the whole thing. It was quite heroic, but I started out with trying to paint him as, you know, again, kind of the everyday man. And it was just like a part of a chapter, really. So my point is, as you're writing, first impressions really count. So if they have a bucket full, maybe, of negative qualities, maybe don't show those first. Maybe show one of the good qualities, even as you're maybe trying to dole out some of the bad qualities. I think that's important for the reader to really glom on the character.
That dole out, that's really important. Yeah. That's really important to not just slap them with everything at one time.
Right.
Which is also, and by the way, is the way that we encounter people in real life, right? When you first meet someone, you don't go, someone with medium build and dark hair and glasses and wearing a thing and a backpack, and, you know, like, you don't do that, right? You sort of take in a general impression, and there may be a couple things that stand out, and that's why you'll see on police procedurals like Law and Order, they'll ask witnesses, what do you remember? And it'll be one or two things, you know, like a red hat, they were wearing something with a logo on the shirt, and that's because that's the way we will often imagine ourselves to be, and the sort of detectives in these police procedurals who are the best are the ones who are trained to notice many more details than we generally do quickly. So they can be like, oh, I remember Sherlock Holmes is an example. I notice all these details. The reason everyone thinks this guy's a genius is because he's trained to recognize details that most of us don't see. But the key thing to keep in mind is your readers are not going to be Sherlock Holmes. They don't want to be treated as that way either. They are normal people, and you need to think about the way normal people interact, and that is they will take a sort of general impression of someone and remember a couple of distinct things, but they are not likely to remember 15 things about that person, whether they be positive or negative things about them. Yeah. Sorry,
Wendy. No, it's okay.
I think, along with what you said, we mentioned Zelazny already. You had a very wonderful, very spare, economical way of writing it that really works well. And one of the things he said was that generally when he introduced a character, he would have be like, you know, two details of physical description. And he said if you pick the right two, the reader will fill in the rest.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I think I've read a similar article by Roger Zelazny. And then later, he would add one or two more details during further narrative or dialogue or description. So at the end, you could know 10 things about that character, but in the beginning, he would give you only the two.
Being careful not to do something, by the way, which is incredibly jarring, though. I mean, you know, so if you're introduced to you and then you mention, you know, 200 pages in and they, you know, could only ride in a wheelchair, immediately that sound you hear is someone's, you know, mind shifting without a clutch, right? Like, what? You know? So you need to make sure that the stuff you're doing is sort of makes sense to be filled in later on. As you would notice something, you know, more about something as you got to know them better, you would begin to notice more details as you spent more time.
Yeah, if the character is a lobster man from Jupiter, that probably should be one of those first two initial details.
But
it
didn't matter. He was more than that, Richard.
I loved him.
So I don't even know where to go with that. Okay, so let's open it up to some questions. If we could start maybe with some questions first, that would be better. We have about a little over almost 15 minutes, so maybe start with some questions and move into some comments. Sure.
Early on, one of y'all said something to the effect that a protagonist has to feel comfortable in their own skin. And yet, lately in TV and movies, we've seen middle schoolers who are classically not fitting into their own skin. We see people in very uncomfortable situations in American comedies, Something About Mary, or British comedies. How do you create the right kind of a character flaw where it's believable, where it's just not like aliens are building a new highway through Earth, and it's going to be destroyed. I mean, that's so much.
Right. I think I mentioned that, and you're quite right. I guess I should rephrase a little bit. It's not so much that they're comfortable in their own skin if they don't get along with people, or I mean, that's part of it, but that they're familiar in their own skin, right? That they know the sorts of things that are flawed about themselves. And if they don't fit in, and I imagine, you know, all of us will have had experiences at some point where we'll feel like a certain group, we may not have, everyone goes through this. At that time, you were very conscious that you didn't fit in, you didn't know why, but you were very comfortable of it as being part of you, and you needed to figure out, how do I fit in better? Why am I like this? But you always used it that way. Why am I like this? Why am I this kind of person, right? So that, I think, is the sort of distinction I would make as far as that's concerned. But I don't know what the panelists think about how to avoid the anything but alien highway problem. Okay.
Well, I don't think that characters need to feel comfortable in their own skin in the sense of, you know, like, you know, I like myself, I'm swell.
No, right.
You know?
No.
But I mean, I think that, you know, I think their flaws have to be of such a nature that they don't paralyze them. Ultimately your protagonist is going to need to act.
You know,
he's going to need to engage with the story problem. I mean, as far as how do you say how do you keep? What's the question? Like how to create flaws that keep us from not sympathizing with him? Is that what you're asking?
Well, you want to sympathize. You want the reader to sympathize with the character,
right?
But you don't want the flaw to be so brutal or to be so not important that it doesn't fit.
Well, I mean, the flaw often should have a relationship to what's going to happen to the character. A lot of stories are driven by the fact that you know, on some level, the external problem ultimately you know, relates to the internal flaw, and by defeating one, the character has to defeat both to defeat either. I mean, a lot of stories are constructed. Another way of saying that is okay. You've kind of come up with what the story problem is going to be. It's like, what kind of character would be hit really hard by this? You know, would find this particularly difficult to cope with, but nonetheless, we'll be able to cope because you know, it's like, or to what kind of character would this problem be, you know, particularly intolerable? You know, so you would have to act. I mean, that's one way of going. You know, look at the external problem and see what you can set up internally that's going to relate to it.
Because it creates, and it also creates again that sense of greater interest in the story, right? The ancient Greeks have a saying, character is destiny. Who you are is what will happen to you, right? And so in that sense, if you think, to go back to the Indiana Jones example, right? Indiana Jones, how many times does he say, I had to be snakes, I hate snakes, right? We find that fun. I mean, I'm using a facetious example, but we find that amusing because we're like, well, of course, he's the one who has to deal with the snakes. But partly that's because if you don't have a story like that, if he runs into a bunch of guys carrying whips, I can just shoot them. That wouldn't be interesting after a while, right? How many times does that joke work? Only a couple times. It's the reason we have to put in obstacles that we aren't suited to handle is because that's what makes it more interesting. How is the character going to adapt or not adapt to the situation that's been placed in front of him, a situation or her, a situation that he or she never imagined or is like, I hope this never happens, and then it happens. That's what makes the story in part interesting. How do they deal with the most difficult obstacle you can put in front of them, and how do they overcome that obstacle in that sense?
Think of the example from Pulp Fiction when these two horrible characters are killers. They're so sympathetic, right? We love them because there's so many people so much more disgusting. And the one thing that might have been the worst that could have happened were these awful men in this pawn shop or gun shop who are going to rape them, right? So you have these, what should be, very unsympathetic characters having a first conversation about another unsympathetic character doing something even worse than we know that they're going to do, right?
Yeah.
Throwing some guy out a window. And then what could you do horrible to them? Well, S&M rapists.
That is the definition of setting your bar very low.
but you know, it does illustrate an important point, which is that, you know, there are kinds of fiction where you know, it's sufficient for the protagonist to be the best of a bad lot.
Yes.
Like, I'm a big fan of the Parker novels, right. Which were published by Richard Stark. They're really by Donald Westlake. Yeah. He was Richard Stark, but I mean, and Parker is Parker is just about as cold-blooded a career criminal as you're going to come across. But he looks pretty damn good compared to a lot of other people in those books.
Yeah. Vic Mackey of The Shield.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
I think this is why it's important to consider the story type as well. The examples that you gave are, and I don't know all of them, but they sounded like character stories to me. Like a lot of teen angst, type episodic shows are, they're just trying to fit in. They're trying to find their way in the world, right? They're trying to change themselves and grow and get away from their parents a little bit, and something about Mary, Ben Stiller's character is it's comedy, but he's trying to find love, really. And so I would just say, be careful that you aren't adopting tropes from one type of story and thinking that I need to apply these in another.
Right. One very quick example then is just I wanted to mention before is the character of Grendel from Gardner's brilliant book. As an example of someone who we imagine constantly as the ultimate antagonist, right? That's the antagonist until we encounter him as the protagonist in his own story. There is a person, I call him that because of the way he is, interacts, a monster who is anything but comfortable in himself. Anything, is completely isolated from everything, including himself. But we find him incredibly fascinating because even the flaws that he possesses are things that at some level he has to hold on to because he has nothing else in this world, including his mother that he can't communicate with, including the humans who are portrayed as psychotic mafiosos in this book. He can't identify with anyone or anything in a way but his own flaws himself. And that's what makes his story so fascinating and so deeply tragic. And it is a great book. If you haven't read it, Grendel by John Gardner. Okay. If you haven't read it, it is a tremendously important book, I think, especially for writers to read. And I teach it in my fantasy fiction class, so I'm very passionate about this book. And it's just extremely, extremely well written.
Correct.
Something. Oh.
Yes, sir.
that you keep saying keeps making me think of something, and that's uncomfortable in your own skin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Rather, it's not a matter of comfort. It's a matter of, I don't imagine there's anybody in here who doesn't think they have a flaw that they need to fix. But at the same time, it's really hard to fix it. It's really hard not to react in ways that in set patterns. And so when you try to change yourself, and that's back to Brad's mice with the character, sometimes your own flaws can be the antagonist.
Yeah. And sometimes it's very hard to get rid of flaws that you're familiar with, even if you don't like them. You were going to say?
It was kind of on the topic of flaws. I guess this is almost probably another panel topic in and of itself, the flaw of the character, but how much variety can a flaw have? I mean, there's, the simple basic flaws like, they're a sociopath kind of thing. But, I mean, flaws such as the character can't trust anyone, the character has problems, loving people, the character has... I mean, there's the simple, obvious flaws, like, I'm terrified of snakes. Uh-huh. But there are other flaws, too, and, I guess the question is, how valid can some of them be?
Well, I think it strikes a chord with me a little bit in the term fatal flaw. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of it's not just maybe their biggest flaw, but it's also the thing that's keeping them from achieving the thing that they want to achieve.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so when you're crafting a story and you're writing this type of story, you're often trying to pit the opposition in such a way that it challenges that fatal flaw the most. And so at some point in the story, that character will reach a low point where their beliefs are completely challenged, and they have to at that point, crumble or rise above, right? And so, again, we're talking about that fatal flaw, so it's challenged, they rise above it, and at the end of the story, they have changed. That fatal flaw is maybe gone, maybe changed a little bit. And we see this change in the character, and we feel like they have... we feel satisfaction because we've seen this change in them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's also worth noting that characters can have, can have the kind of major flaw, which the kind that I was talking about before, where it's really an important component of the problem. They can also have some kind of smaller flaws, just sort of for character? Are you just to enrich
don't like
the character?
Pizza?
Oh, yeah, it's like you know. I mean Sherlock Holmes is vain. That doesn't usually figure into the resolution of a Sherlock Holmes story. You know, it's just part of who he is. I mean, I've got a character that I'm currently writing about in my Realm stuff, who, because of the way he was brought up, has a, you know, you can see that he has a great natural capacity for, you know, friendship and affection and loyalty. But he's also a character that was brought up in circumstances that made him feel like, you know, you should never let yourself be put in a situation. You should never let yourself get to the spot where you feel like you need people, need any one individual. You should always, okay, I can have friends, I can have comrades, but I'm never going to need anybody again. You know, I'm always going to be self-sufficient. And that's part of who he is. And as these novels continue, I mean, you know, I don't think it's a big spoiler to say that we're probably going to get to some, you know, kind of a crunch point with that, you know, where the two competing tendencies in him, you know, we're going to have to see what's really, you know, which way he's ultimately going to go. But, you know, it hasn't happened yet. You know, and I don't know at this point, at what point in the series it will happen. I'll get around to telling that particular story. But so, you know, flaws don't always have to be, by God, it's gonna be an integral plot, and it's gonna work out in this particular story if you're working with an ongoing character.
Time for go ahead, sorry.
No, it's okay. Go ahead.
Just time for like one or two more. We're just about out.
One of the things you're talking about that occurred to me with there are a lot of characters that the flaws that they have, main characters, are actually an integral part of them and an important part, and it's what makes them effective in the story. And the best examples I come up with, right offhand, Ender from the Orson Scott Card books, and Kvothe from Name of the Wind. Mm-hmm. Both, their abilities or their viewpoints lead them to be separate from everybody else, and at the same time lead them to be effective in the story itself.
Mm-hmm.
So if you overcame the flaw, you'd be killing the character.
Using example of one of the most famous examples of Oedipus, similar to this, right? I mean, what makes Oedipus as effective a leader as he is that he is utterly self-confident and fully convinced in what he calls his own mother wit that allowed him to defeat the Sphinx and liberate the people of that city and take over as their ruler. That is also the exact same thing which brings him low, because he is unwilling to accept help from anybody else, because he is incredibly self-pride, you know, is filled with pride and supremely self-confident and arrogant and convinced of his own mother wit. And as a result, he doesn't listen to the clues that he should. He pursues things single-mindedly, believing it's always worked in the past. He mocks the gods as he does this. And what you learn in ancient Greek drama is do not mock the gods, because they will get you. And so he really does all these things, and it's very much what you say. The same exact thing that operates as a strength becomes his weakness. And again, that's that character's destiny point in both ways, ultimately.
The example that sprung to my mind was that, you know, was Batman. You know, if you interpret Batman as a maladjusted, psychologically maladjusted character, which is not the only way to interpret him, although it is a very common one. I mean, you have to say, well, you know, if he ever got over mom and dad's murder, he'd hang up the king. You know,
you wouldn't find him interesting anymore. Okay, so I think we have time for one more quick one. Yes.
Do you find when you're writing, I don't know how to say it exactly, but your character, your story doesn't go the way you expect it to go from the very beginning?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Yeah, all the time.
Pisses me off.
James characters.
What's wrong with you? Yeah.
Makes my husband think I need a straitjacket.
Yeah, I know. Because you get into arguments. What? You're sitting. That's actually happened to me, right? My wife is like, what are you talking about? Like, why are you doing this? Don't do that. But that's the sign, actually, that you've made a really meaningful character, I think, because the character almost lives slightly, not totally. Some authors are like, well, he's completely independent. Well, not really. I mean, I am writing the person, but they're operating at least. They're operating at least somewhat independently from me, and that's kind of what I said before about you close the book and the character goes on without you. That means they have to a degree, find their own way a little bit.
So that's a good thing.
That's a good.
Even if you feel yeah. schizophrenic when it happens.
I think so. Yeah. I'm just going to say that it is.
I think you just have to learn when to rein it in.
Yeah.
I had a character that was just running away with me, and I was at a con somewhere. I think it was Jennifer Robertson. Mm-hmm. And she said, it's great to do that, but you have at some point you have to be able to recognize when to pull back,
yeah.
when to rein him in and say, no, sorry, you can't do that. It's not going to work.
Yeah.
I think that, the character's in control and the story goes where it goes. You hear people say that. With me, not so much, you know. I mean, it's, a lot of things happen, you know, a lot of things happen in the story that surprised me as it's unfolding, but it's because I haven't like worked out every detail in advance. You know, it's like I'm discovering new things about characters. But I think that for me at least, when you go into a story, it's valuable to go in and say, I know which character this story is ultimately about. I know who the protagonist is. I know what the essential story problem is. And I know the end point I'm trying to get to. And I usually have that much. And it I'll surprise myself, but it's not like, the character was supposed to, go to Mars and, fight the spider demon in the slime pit. But, nah, he decided to go to Toronto.
Same thing. That puts us at time. If you haven't brought up your tickets, please do so for leave. And thank you all very, very much.
Did you get
it? Yes, I did.